On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's trip to New York is turning into a doozy. The city that hosted Fidel Castro, calling JFK ignorant, Yasser Arafat with a pistol on his hip, and Nikita Khrushchev banging the UN podium with his shoe, has gone after Ahmadinejad with a vengeance. Bearded blowhard, said the New York Post. Petty, cruel dictator, said Columbia University's president to the face of his invited guest. Ahmadinejad is delivering some doozies of his own, but behind all the theater, there is a real risk of brutal war. Up next, On Point, the U.S., Iran, and Ahmadinejad in New York. In a moment, we'll hear from the Columbia University professor who helped bring the Iranian president to campus. And later this hour, we will check in on the political crisis in Myanmar, where Buddhist monks marched again today. But first, joining me from New York is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She's author of The Last Great Revolution, Turmoil and Transition in Iran. She covered the Iranian president's appearance at Columbia yesterday. Robin Wright, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be with you.
You were in the hall with a lot of students who were pretty geared up with the Iranian president and with a very fired up Columbia president. What, at the end of all that, what was the mood in there yesterday? What were people saying about what happened?
Well, it was really an extraordinary event. I think that Ahmadinejad has probably not faced that kind of confrontation publicly in his career. President Bolger of Colombia was provocative in calling him a petty and cruel dictator, and said that he was either brazenly provocative or astonishingly uneducated when it came to some of his positions, such as denial of the Holocaust. And denial of Iran's role in supporting extremism. It was quite a tirade as an opening introduction. And in fact, Ahmadinejad shot back immediately when he took the stage and said, in my country, we don't insult people when we invite them to speak. He repeated many of his old positions, trying to explain when it came to the issue of Israel that for him, part of it was that the Palestinians were paying a price for the Holocaust. He kind of backed down a little bit on the Holocaust and said, even if it's true, which is about as far as he's ever gone. But it was a hostile confrontation, and the room was, you could cut the knife with the tension in it.
What was your sense of the students witnessing this extraordinary exchange and moment? What sort of attitudes were coming up from the crowd?
Well, I think many of them anticipated some of his political positions or foreign policy positions. But what really drew a gasp from the crowd and even then open laughter was when the Iranian leader said that there are no homosexuals in Iran like there are in the United States. And he had no idea who suggested that there might be. President Bolger had asked him a question about the harassment of and even execution of gays in Iran, and which produced this response. And I think that of all the answers he gave yesterday, this is the one that probably stuck out the most as being so ridiculous. We all know his positions on other issues, but this was the first time he'd said something this outrageous.
Sexuality, there an issue, but war and peace also on the table. Robin, what is theater here in all of this, and what's important? Or is the theater the message somehow?
Well, one of the interesting things that we are all going to have to monitor is what comes of this visit. At every stage, from the 60 Minutes interview to the questions of the National Press Club, the delivery of the speech at Columbia, his engagement with a number in the evenings after the Ramadan break, the fast dinner, and he is fasting while he's here. He's meeting with various groups. It'll be interesting to see what repercussions there are in the developing world and in Iran, whether this has weakened him in the eyes of his own people because others have stood up to him, or whether people will rally to his side because they feel that he's been insulted publicly.
Will Iranians even know how he was received in New York? Will they see that on Iranian television?
I don't think they'll see that at all on Iranian television, but with the internet being very active outside of Israel, Iran has the greatest number of websites and engagement in with the internet of any country in the Middle East, and it will seep back, I think.
Could you feel, Robin, right, in President Ahmadinejad's presentation of himself and his message, an awareness that there is so much war talk around him and his country and the U.S. in Washington?
I think he was aware of it. He did make allusions to the fact that there was no need for war. He reached out and said that he was willing to let a Columbia University delegation come to Iran. I think there was a sense that you've seen this in a number of interviews, in the 60 Minutes interview of the National Press Club as well, an awareness that he is not looking for confrontation right now. He's aware of the tension. What's one of the most interesting things is that Ali Shakari, the fourth American imprisoned in Iran, mm-hmm. was released on the very day of Ahmadinejad's appearances in New York. This wraps up the four people who detained or imprisoned in Iran with American citizenship. There's still one former FBI agent missing in Iran, but it's interesting that this was all wrapped up.
And finally, Robin, on 60 Minutes, talking with Scott Pelley, he was asked if it was the goal of Iran, his country, to build a nuclear weapon. There's a kind of a rambling answer, but he finally says that his answer is a firm no. Does anyone believe that?
Look, with the Iraq experience, we all have to be very careful about assuming what countries are doing. It is true that Iran did not confess to a secret program for 18 years for uranium enrichment. The problem is that process, which can be used for peaceful nuclear energy, can also be subverted for a nuclear weapon. And I don't think anyone has all the hard evidence they'd like about this. But Ahmadinejad avoids this answer in many ways. He says he doesn't say outright no. He says the age of the bomb has ended. If it were useful, the Soviet Union would not have collapsed. He is very evasive, as are many Iranians. They insist that there's no need for a bomb. But, there's still the gap between questions anyway about what the reality is.
Robin Wright is diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, joining us from New York. Robin, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Joining us now from New York is Richard Bullitt, professor of history at Columbia University's Middle East Institute. He's a longtime Iran watcher, author of The Case for Islamo-Christian Civilization. He worked with Iran's UN ambassador to bring President Ahmadinejad to Columbia's campus yesterday for the controversial forum. Richard Bullitt, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Is this the event you hoped for when you invited the Iranian president to Columbia?
Not really. I had not expected a circus, as it turned out to be, but I don't regret that it happened this way. I think that it made it all the more educational to see so many facets of a debate between our country and Iran surface.
When the president of your university, Columbia, Lee Bollinger, your boss, said to the face of the Iranian president, "Today I feel all the weight of the modern civilized world yearning to express revulsion at what you stand for," what were your thoughts? Do you agree with President Bollinger there?
I wouldn't have chosen those words, but the Iranians had been forewarned that there would be, quote, sharp challenges in the introduction by President Bollinger. And these were sharp challenges. I don't think that the Iranians had had thought about how sharp they would be, and I was rather taken aback myself at the tenor of the president's address.
Why did you work to invite the Iranian president to speak at Columbia? Of course, he was coming to the UN, and the UN is there and it's international. He can do that. But why did you go beyond that to get him onto the Columbia campus with that forum, that microphone, that audience?
He had been invited last year. The invitation had been rescinded because of what were presented as logistic and security problems. In the interim, sometime, I believe, in January, President Bollinger had said at a meeting of the University Senate that if proper preparations were made, there's no reason why he might not someday speak at Columbia. So when it came to this August, and I was called in by the Iranian UN ambassador and asked whether I would be an emissary to President Bollinger to see whether last year's invitation could be renewed. I didn't feel that I had much of a choice in the matter. I think that the decision had to be the president's decision, not mine. And in a sense, since it was a request to renew an invitation rather than to inaugurate an Iranian request to speak on campus, it made it harder to deal with than I think for the president than it would have been if it had been a flat-out letter saying, can I speak at Columbia? Mm. I think he would have gotten a flat-out no.
With the Iranian president on stage yesterday, Columbia University president Lee Bollinger tore into the visiting Iranian head, but defended the principles of free speech.
It should never be thought that merely to listen to ideas we deplore in any way implies our endorsement of those ideas or our weakness of our resolve to resist those ideas or our naivete about the very real dangers inherent in such ideas.
Within minutes, the Iranian president was asked directly about Israel.
The question is, do you or your government seek the destruction of the state of Israel as a Jewish state? And I think you could answer that question with a single word, either yes or no.
You ask the question and then you want the answer the way you want to hear it. Well, this isn't really a free flow of information. I'm just telling you what my position is. I'm asking you, is the Palestinian issue not an international issue of prominence or not? Please tell me, yes or no? There's a plight of a people.
The answer to your question is yes.
Well, thank you for your cooperation. It is we recognize there's a problem there that's been going on for 60 years.
President Ahmadinejad in the hot seat at Columbia yesterday. We've been joined from New York by Professor Richard Bullitt. He's a professor of history at Columbia University's Middle East Institute. He helped arrange yesterday's visit by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to Columbia. We're also joined right now from Washington, D.C., by Patrick Clausen, Deputy Director for Research of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, formerly a Senior Research Professor at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, the National Defense University, co-author of Eternal Iran, Continuity and Chaos, and Checking Iran's Nuclear Ambitions. Patrick Clausen, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
First, to Richard Bullitt's effort and the fruit of it we saw yesterday, Ahmadinejad on stage at Columbia University. You heard the Columbia president defended as an example of American free speech. What do you say?
Exchange of information is what the universities are for. Propaganda events, on the other hand, do not add to a university's reputation. And I'm afraid that I thought that yesterday's event saw very little information being exchanged and much more of the propaganda side.
Should he have been there at all?
If he were, in fact, interested in a give and take of ideas, I would say absolutely. But we saw Mr. Ahmadinejad repeatedly evade questions and give absurd answers that denied reality. So I didn't find it a very edifying event.
And do you think, Patrick Clausen, that Iran and the United States stand today and in the months ahead at risk of war?
No. In fact, there's a diplomatic process underway to resolve the conflict over the nuclear program, which is the most acute issue separating the two countries. I happen to be reasonably optimistic that in the end of the day that there will be a diplomatic resolution of the matter. But certainly the Bush administration has been quite committed to that diplomatic process. And indeed, our European allies have now talked about a whole variety of new steps that they want to take to move that process forward. At the very least, the diplomatic process has got quite a bit of time to play out. Meanwhile, the Iranian program is proceeding slowly enough that we have time to resolve this matter.
Richard Bullitt, how do you assess that risk of war? We've heard recently on this show from pretty experienced Washington watchers that they see a real risk before the end of President Bush's term. Do you see that risk of war as real, as merely hypothetical, as deeply secondary to a diplomatic effort?
I don't believe there will be a war before the end of the Bush administration. I believe that it would interfere so profoundly with our presidential election process and be so adverse to the interests of the Republican Party that even if you had a powerful contingent within the government wanting a war, I don't think that there's a window of opportunity still remaining to have one.
Patrick Claussen, can you imagine circumstances, not crazy circumstances, but possible circumstances in which war might be a necessary option for the U.S. with Iran?
If Iran were to make an unexpected breakthrough with its nuclear program, and if Iran were to show clear indications that it's headed towards a nuclear weapon, for instance, by throwing out U.N. inspectors, then we would be in a real crisis. And if after a period of time that crisis couldn't be resolved diplomatically, then I would think that preemptive military force might be considered. But it's hard to imagine that happening as quickly as over the next 15 months. That process would probably unfold over the course of a few years at the earliest. I don't think it's likely to happen.
I want to get each of you responding to the Iranian president on 60 Minutes Sunday night. He was talking with reporter Scott Pelley in advance of his appearances in New York about Iranian nuclear ambitions.
Is it your goal to build a nuclear bomb?
Kodom.
What are you driving at?
Simply that, sir. Is it the goal of your government, the goal of this nation, to build
again,
a nuclear weapon?
Do you think that the nuclear technology is only limited in a bomb? You can only build a bomb with that?
I appreciate the differences, sir, but the question is limited to the
uses.
Bomb.
Well, you have to appreciate. We don't need a nuclear bomb. We don't need that. What need do we have for a bomb? So,
may I take that as a no, sir?
Please let me finish my thought. It is a firm no. I'm going to be much firmer now.
Professor Richard Bullitt, after all the issues, the Holocaust and gays and you name it in New York, what about this central issue? The Iranian president saying there it is a firm no to apparently to Scott Pelley's question of whether or not it's his nation's goal to build a nuclear weapon. If that is indeed a firm no, do you believe it, Professor?
Well, yes, I certainly believe it because about the earliest timetable, as Pat Claussen was saying, for the development of Iranian nuclear weapon will go beyond the retirement year of George Bush and in all likelihood the retirement year of Ahmadinejad since he comes up for potential reelection 7 months after Bush leaves office. So whatever happens with Iranian nukes, it isn't going to be Ahmadinejad's call as whether to go to the point of testing or the point of using a bomb. And I think when he says no, I think he's also an affirm no. I think he's saying, well, it isn't his call. It will be perhaps, as Pat says, somewhere down the line it'll be someone's call, but it's not going to be his because the likelihood of his being reelected given his difficulties domestically is fairly low.
Patrick Claussen, is it Ahmadinejad's call whether or not Iran is working, will work on a nuclear bomb, or is this a deeper agenda that goes beyond his tenure in office, which will, as Richard Bullitt says, expire not long after George Bush's?
Ahmadinejad is the president of Iran, and we often think of a president of a country as the man who sets the government's agenda. But in Iran, in fact, the real power is in the hands of the supreme leader. His title may give you some hint of his powers. It's the supreme leader who's the commander-in-chief and who's in charge of national security issues like the nuclear program. And neither Ahmadinejad nor his predecessor, Khatami, have had any particular influence over the direction of the nuclear program. Ahmadinejad likes to use the nuclear program as the setting for his propaganda events, but in fact the key decisions are taken by the supreme leader, and indeed the negotiations with the West about the program are by a representative of the supreme leader, and Mr. Ahmadinejad doesn't appear to be even consulted about what happens on the matter.
I want to begin to hear from our listeners on his visit, on this relationship, on statements we heard yesterday, and on the road ahead. Let's go first to Charleston, South Carolina, and George. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just want to say in the beginning, I was in the Foreign Service, and I spent 5 years in Iran. I spoke the language. The Iranians, in the first place, are certainly not a warlike people. And secondly, I want to emphasize the fact I think the incivility of the president of Columbia University is inexcusable for a man in his position, for a university like that, having invited the president of Iran and to treat him and make those comments, I think, is inexcusable.
Inexcusable, but was he wrong, George, in his characterization?
Well, I don't know that I can judge that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that all the questions that we argue about are that important, you know, whether he has have gays or not in the country, or whether, how they treat women. Mm. It's a part of it as a cultural matter. So, in respect to decent manners, and I think he was totally wrong. In terms of facts, he may be partially right or partially wrong, but the point is that he invited the man, and I think it's totally uncalled for him to have acted the way he did.
George, we appreciate your voice of experience and your view. Thanks very much for that. Let's get a call as well from Destin, Florida. Webb, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy?
All right.
I'm so glad I was listening this morning, because when I heard that the guy from Iran was coming and they were going to let him in, because I feel like that's our sacred ground in New York, and for him and Chavez to be able to come in and spit in our face the way they do, I was just amazed that that president handled it the way he did, because I think it really might have pulled the wolf's clothes off the sheep's clothes off the wolf like he is, and I think America needs to wake up and really see what's going on.
So you're glad for the dressing down that he gave Ahmadinejad, even though he'd invited him in?
Man, I'm going to be honest with you. I know I'm from the South and everything, but I wouldn't care if somebody put a crosshair on him and put him out, because I think but I know that's not going to happen, but I think that was the next best thing. Yes, sir, I do.
There we're into some pretty severe territory. It should be noted that with the UN in New York, anybody, foreign officials are welcome there when they come for the UN, and to be within a 25-mile radius of New York, that is global policy and American policy. Let's take a call from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, I want to commend you on an excellent panel, because you have two individuals who have a track record over the past several years that we can look at and evaluate their judgment. So I have a question for each of them. Mr. Clausen, you gave an interview back in the eve of the war with the NewsHour, in which you compared the post-Iraq situation to post-war Japan, and were optimistic that democracy would come to flourish there. You also are quoted in Seymour Hersh's piece in April 2006 as advocating clandestine activities, including industrial accidents within Iran, to overthrow the government. My question for you is, do you still advocate that? And if I could switch to Professor Bullitt, you have written cautioning not to use post-war Japan as an exemplar, because it had nothing to do with the history of Iraq, and you have advised the next president to do everything possible to see that Mr. Ahmadinejad is defeated in 2009. And my question for you is, do you think Mr. Clausen's proposed activities of industrial sabotage and the treatment that the president of Colombia gave to Mr. Ahmadinejad would enhance or lessen his chances of getting reelected in 2009?
Mark, let us pick those up. And thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Patrick Clausen, first to you. I think we can dispense with post-war Japan as the model in Iraq. That's clearly not happening. But what about sabotage toward Iran by the U.S. government? Mark says Seymour Hersh reports you supporting that. Did you? Do you?
No, and I did not, and Mr. Hersh did not quote me as saying that. What Mr. Hersh did quote me as saying is that I pointed out that in the event that preventative military force is decided upon by the United States government, that it would not necessarily have to take the form of bombing, that the United States might have other ways of preventing Iran's nuclear program proceeding if the United States decided that that were necessary. I was just noting that airstrikes are not the only means available to the United States if it decides that preventative military force is necessary. By the way, if I may say so, I had thought that universities, probably, prided themselves on speaking truth to power, and I thought that that is what President Bollinger was doing. In the best tradition of universities, the BU is speaking truth to power. That is usually said mm-hmm. by people on the liberal side of the spectrum as being what a university should do, and it's intriguing to me that when a university president does that to somebody who, like Mr. Ahmadinejad, we suddenly hear that it's impolite to speak truth to power.
Yeah, we're hearing both sides of response to that today. Let me ask you, Patrick Claussen. Richard Bullitt said earlier that he believed if the U.S. and Iran went to war, it would be a catastrophe for everyone. Do you believe that?
Oh, I think that war is always a catastrophe and a failure of diplomacy. The only question is whether or not there would be a worse disaster if the United States did not take out Iranian nuclear facilities. And my great fear is that if Iran goes nuclear, so will many other countries around the Middle East and around the world. And I do not want to see us living in a world with 20 more nuclear powers. I think that if there could then be some kind of an accidental nuclear war or nuclear war by miscalculation, and many, many, many people would die. So, yes, a war or strikes by the United States on Iran would be a disaster. The only question is whether or not they would be a way to prevent an even worse disaster.
And, Richard Bullitt, our caller's questions for you. Essentially, do you see the president's visit, Ahmadinejad's visit, making his reelection more or less likely in Iran? Is there any chance of him being reelected?
Well, of course, there's a chance of being reelected, except I don't think that things are trending in his direction now. If this took place next year instead of this year, it might be closer to the reelection event to have a difference. I think one thing that that George pointed out earlier, and I take Patrick's point about speaking truth to power, but in Iranian culture, there is almost nothing that is considered bad in personal behavior. That is considered worse in personal behavior than being rude to a guest. Mahmoud-Doust friendship to the guest is almost a defining characteristic of Iranian culture, and to say that someone is bi-adab, that they are impolite, is a very serious charge. So if this is televised and the tape is played in Iran, I think that the introduction by President Bollinger, which seemed to many people to be appropriate, in this country, though some people thought it was inappropriate, I think that will be seen as exceedingly aggressive in an Iranian context, and that kind of behavior could indeed boost his popularity. But we're too far ahead of the reelection campaign for that to be a significant worry now.
Of course, Ahmadinejad and President Bush speaking before the UN today at this airing. President Bush has spoken with a reference to Iran in his speech. Let's listen.
Every civilized nation also has a responsibility to stand up for the people suffering under dictatorship. In Belarus, North Korea, Syria, and Iran, brutal regimes deny their people the fundamental rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration.
So the subject is on the table. Richard Bullitt joins us from Columbia University, one of those who helped invite the Iranian president there yesterday. Patrick Claussen is with us from Washington, D.C. He's with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, co-author of Eternal Iran. We have a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Ahmed is calling from Montreal. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just want to make two comments, one about the Holocaust, one about Iraq. About the Holocaust, I don't think he's denying that it happened. I think he's just saying to investigate to the extent that it happened. And the other point was concerning, since the Germans are the ones who committed the Holocaust, why don't we give land from Germany instead of giving land from the Arabs who didn't commit anything? That's, I think, if we don't look at the person who's saying the thing, just the comment itself, it is a valid point.
Ahmed, let me ask you then, when you say he's just talking about the extent, are you then, I mean, isn't that questioning the fact, it's called a Holocaust because of the millions who died. Are you doubting those numbers?
I didn't research the subject, so I can't say, but there is some people who are saying that it could be not 6 million, it could be lower. He's just saying to investigate the issue. But the point about taking the land from Germany instead of taking the land from Palestine, that's a valid point.
Let's hear from Ahmadinejad yesterday at Columbia and then go to my guest. First, Ahmadinejad saying, well, let's look at Holocaust research, as university questioners tried to pin him down on his position.
Given that the Holocaust is a present reality of our time, a history that occurred, why is there not sufficient research that can approach the topic from different perspectives? Our friend referred to 1930 as the point of departure for this development. However, I believe the Holocaust, from what we read, happens during World War II after 1930 in the 1940s. So, you know, we have to really be able to trace the event.
More research, said the Iranian president, on the Holocaust, and then he turned to the issue of the Palestinians.
You know quite well that Palestine is an old wound, as old as 60 years. For 60 years, these people are displaced. For 60 years, these people are being killed. For 60 years, on a daily basis, there's conflict and terror.
Richard Bullitt, you helped invite Ahmadinejad to Colombia. When he raises these kind of fundamental questions about the Holocaust, do you cringe in your seat? Do you agree that this needs to be revisited? And how would this be heard in Iran?
I don't think it resonates very strongly with the Iranian people. I cringe a little bit because he appears to be so ill-informed. But on the other hand, when people ridicule him for saying there needs to be more study of the Holocaust, this flies in the face of the fact that we have numerous senior professors in the United States who continually do Holocaust studies and continually study the Holocaust. It is not a finished thing. Now, they're not looking to see whether they can reduce the numbers. They're looking at other aspects of the Holocaust, and I don't think that Ahmadinejad is probably even aware of this research. But when he said this time that it's a historical fact that it occurred, I felt that was a somewhat more forthcoming answer than he's given in the past.
Patrick Clausen, Ahmadinejad outrageous on the Holocaust or raising academic questions?
He's not been interested in academic research about this. When he held a conference about the Holocaust, he invited such famous Holocaust historians as David Duke, the former leader of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. He did not invite the eminent historians who studied the Holocaust to his conference. And that shows a great deal about what his agenda is. His agenda is denying the Holocaust, and he says that he's going just raising questions, which has been the approach of Holocaust deniers for a long time. As Professor Bullitt points out, there is a distinguished body of research on the Holocaust, and if Mr. Ahmadinejad is interested in learning about it, I'm sure that the German government would be happy to help him learn more about the history of Germany and Central Europe. But there's no indications Ahmadinejad has any interest in that. My goodness gracious, even an Iranian diplomat helped save hundreds and hundreds of Jews in France. And there has been a television show in Iran. The number one television show in Iran for the last few months has been about this diplomat and his saving Jews. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ahmadinejad could just watch Iranian television and learn a great deal about the Holocaust.
Let's take a call from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and esteemed guests. There, one subject ought to go right off the table right away. I mean, there should be no debate about whether the president of Iran should have been invited. That is precisely what the university is about. That's what the UN is about. Indeed, that's what America is about.
And yet you know there is an enormous debate. It has been about that, Sam. It is on the table.
Well, I know, and of course, Bollinger's comments in front of the president, as a previous caller just mentioned, absolutely rankle the Iranians to see the guest treated that way. I would suggest that Bollinger's, the extremeness of his comments, were aimed at placating one of the smallest and arguably loudest ethnic groups in the United States, and that's who he was playing to there, and I think that's just uncalled for. 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. We all know that. Another 4 million gays, activists, Catholics.
But do you think the Colombian president could not look at this president and deliver what he said yesterday as an accurate assessment of this Iranian leader?
Well, as has been mentioned, he may not be firing on all cylinders right now, and he's playing to some, I guess, extreme people over on his side of the of this as well. It's people playing to the extremes that cause all of us people of goodwill who are in the middle, you know, whether you're fundamentalist Christian, fundamentalist Islam, fundamentalist Jew, you're causing all the rest of us, people of goodwill and of peace, all the trouble.
Sam, we take your point. Let me get another call here from New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Dr. Bullock, Mr. Clausen. Now, as far as President Bulger's comments, I agree that perhaps his word choice, how he expressed himself, was a little extreme. I would have liked to see him do the same thing in a much more, at least on a surface-level objective way, asking the skewering questions that he did as the day went on. But I have to agree with the point that Mr. Clausen made about speaking truth to power. The world's history, this country's history, has shown that ignoring an evil and hoping it will go away doesn't work. Confronting an evil in the marketplace of ideas, holding it up to the light and letting everyone see just how repulsive it is the thing that changes attitudes.
Mark, thank you very much for that. Let me get one more call. Jafar calling from Boston. Jafar, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and to your guests. I would like to make two points. Number one point is regarding the behavior of the Iranian government for last 30 years versus our own government in the last 30 years. And if you take a look at how many people have died as a result of our actions versus the Iranian government's actions, we will see that we haven't done any better than they have. And the second point is that, which is kind of connected to the first one, because we're not so innocent in this whole process, we should start thinking outside the box. For example, in order to stop Iranian from producing nuclear bombs in the future, we should talk to them about the nuclear program as a disaster waiting to happen, because their program is based on sort of third-party information, third-party equipment. So I think if we start the conversation with the Iran government, telling them we're worried about you and your population, well, your nuclear sites are about, I don't know, 200 miles.
Right, so be sympathetic. It's just your health and well-being that we're concerned about. Would that work? I don't know. Jafar, thank you for that. Our time grows short. Patrick Clausen, you say we are not or do not need to be on a road to war, that there's diplomatic effort underway, and yet all the news we hear is about U.S. officials saying Iranian weapons found in Iran, in Iraq. Iranian officials saying they have the missile capacity to hit U.S. troops in Iraq. Is there evidence that diplomacy is working here?
Well, the two sides, the United States and Iran, have been meeting along with the Iraqi officials, and we have a diplomatic process underway, which does not seem to be working very well with regard to Iraq. And that's disappointing, but I think that we should pursue that just as far as we can.
Patrick Clausen at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Richard Bullitt at Columbia University, do you think Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will be back to your school anytime soon?
I don't think I will get a contact next year asking me to serve as an intermediary.
What an experience. Professor Richard Bullitt at Columbia's Middle East Institute, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
In a moment, the Buddhist monks of Myanmar protest. Myanmar, formerly Burma, is in the midst of its biggest political upheaval in nearly 20 years. Tens of thousands of Buddhist monks have taken to the streets for an eighth day of peaceful protest, defying threats by the country's military junta of a crackdown. Simon Montlake is East Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us now from Bangkok, Thailand. Simon, thanks very much for being here. Where does it appear this confrontation is headed?
Well, so far, it's not actually a confrontation. So far, it's pretty much a one-way street. I mean, we're seeing huge crowds gathering every day, and really, it seems as if they've taken over the streets. The military junta has been remarkably restrained so far. I mean, there were troops which were seen moving running around in the capital, in the commercial center, Rangoon, today, but they didn't actually move in to try and break anything up. So that could be a sign that they are holding off, or it could be a sign that they're regrouping and waiting for their moment to strike.
Remind us of just how unusual this outburst of public protest is in Myanmar.
Well, I can tell you one thing, which is when this started about a month or so ago, initially it was led by student activists, and this group of students are known as the 88 generation, and that is because that was the last time that we saw anything like this in Burma. There was a popular uprising which was even bigger than this, just took over the whole country. And at that time, you know, it did seem like the country was on the verge of a massive change, and yet what happened is a crackdown, and eventually these students ended up going to jail. It's only in the last few years that some of them have emerged from jail, and rather than, you know, give in and repent their ways, they've actually gone out and tried to stir things up again. But, I mean, I think we've seen the biggest protests in 20 years. There's no doubt about that. But the other thing to remember is that the country has really hit some very tough economic times in those years. And what triggered this was actually a rise in fuel prices and a rise in bus prices to the point where people couldn't actually afford to get on the bus and go to work or go to school and were literally walking in the streets. And in some ways, that's where the protest march began from. It began with people saying, well, I can't take the bus. I'm going to just walk down the street. So in some ways, it's just the most incredible economic mismanagement possible for a country which has, you know, oil and gas reserves and other resources as well, but they just seem to have squandered it all.
So at this point, are observers seeing in the protests a challenge to bus prices and economic difficulty, or a more fundamental challenge to the government itself?
Well, it began as economic, there's no doubt about that. And I think also with the monks coming in last week, and this is quite an amazing sight to see, but I think at the beginning what the monks were saying is that we are here to chant prayers, to urge peace. And in some ways they were also saying that the government had not treated monks very well, because earlier smaller protests involving monks had been repressed in a northern city, and some monks had been actually reportedly attacked in the streets and taken away. So it began as a very specific thing, and it wasn't political, but in the last few days what we've seen is that some of the demonstrators are shouting democracy. Some of them are shouting the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the democracy leader who's been in jail for most of the last 18 years, who is still very much an icon of the democratic movement there. So the demands are becoming increasingly political, and I have to say it looks like the crowds on the streets are increasingly expecting some radical changes, not just the bus price to go back down again, but for the regime to either fall or to offer some sort of real democracy which allows the opposition to take part in politics. And, of course, that in itself would bring Burma into something we haven't seen for decades, because, I mean, the military has been ruling in one form or another since the early 1960s, when the first independence government was overthrown. So really you have to reach back a long way to believe that democracy can work in Burma, but these people quite clearly think it's their way forward.
Are there any signs that the government might respond positively to that kind of demand with reforms?
Well, I've asked a lot of people this. I mean, I've not had a chance to see it myself, but from what I can gather, I mean, the military has never really embraced the idea of compromise. As one activist, one former student leader himself said to me, they don't even understand the language of compromise. I mean, the silence we've had for the last few days from the regime changed overnight. There was an address on TV, state TV, on Monday night by a senior minister, who, of course, is a general, basically saying that, you know, monks are being misled, monks must follow their leaders, they must not take part in protests. And that was followed up on Tuesday by trucks driving around Rangoon, the commercial center, and basically broadcasting messages saying, you know, stay home, don't join in these protests. So it's sort of a crescendo building up. Other state newspapers also ran long accounts saying that these monks are misled, that they're being manipulated by foreign forces, that foreign radio stations are causing trouble. I mean, this is a familiar pattern. They've been banging the same drum for a long time now. So there's nothing new in that, and no hint of any compromise with the people who are increasingly looking like they've taken over the streets.
Simon, we've just got 20 seconds here. Why the restraint so far, and could it change in a hurry? Could we see a real crackdown here?
it could change very quickly. They often do these things at night, so that's the time to really watch. One factor is that images are getting out, photos, YouTube footage is getting out, and while that happens, perhaps we could say positively that there is some kind of pressure not to crack down because the images will be broadcast around the world. And clearly that is some kind of restraint, we hope, on the regime.
Simon Motlink, East Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking with us from Bangkok on the upheaval in Myanmar. Simon, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for the time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.